What do you think of when you hear of the word ecosystem? I know if I close my eyes right now and think of it, I see a jungle just teeming with life. I don't really see a town or a city. When I think of ecosystems, I barely even think of people. A lot of us don't think of ourselves as part of an ecosystem. Even when I'm farming, I rarely think that I'm part of an ecosystem, which is kind of silly. We're all part of ecosystems and we can all have a tremendous impact on them, both good and bad, especially agricultural producers. I'm Derek Leahy, and in this episode of Rural Routes to Climate Solutions, we're looking at ecosystem services. So my guest today is Christine Campbell. Christine Campbell is the Western Hub Manager for ALICE Canada. ALICE, if you're not familiar with the organization, stands for Alternative Land Use Services. The organization's mission is to enable Canadians to provide direct support to a national network of farmers, ranchers, delivering ecosystem services in their communities, including clean air, clean water, carbon sequestration, erosion control, flood mitigation, pollinator support, and wildlife habitat. If you haven't noticed, I totally pulled that directly from the website. Christine also shows up at all the eco, hippy-dippy, tree-hugger events that I usually go to, which is really, really great because there's not too many folks from the agricultural community there with me, so we got a lot of like inside jokes together. So, Christine, I'm just going to begin things with a question. How does a city girl from Calgary like you get involved in promoting ecosystem services on farms and ranches across the prairies?
I have no idea. I always say I don't exactly know what my boss was thinking. I have a biology background, and when I was looking for my next role, I knew I wanted to work in the nonprofit sector. That's always been a very important part of who I am. And looking at most organizations, I feel like there's so much of a dichotomy between conservation and the working landscape, whether that's agriculture or other industries. And what I really wanted to do was find a way to marry the two. I had previously worked in reclamation, and that's a really neat part of it. But I think we need to be investing in our ecosystem around us as we're working so that we can actually work more productively.
Okay. Yeah, we were just talking before we got in the recording studio that it's very, very seldom that we think of ourselves as being in an ecosystem. Like we're in an urban center right now, but it is an ecosystem in a way.
Exactly. And it turns out that agriculture gets that probably more than any other industry. So when I stumbled upon ALICE Canada, I just thought, bazinga, this is exactly what I've been saying for years and years. And when I first met with the ALICE team, I came home and I said after, I think I found my tribe.
Okay. Which,
you don't say that very often. So walking away, it was very, very powerful. So it was kind of a no-brainer to join the team.
Awesome. You're actually the only person from ALICE I've ever met. So I look forward to meeting the rest of the tribe if they're like you. Okay, well, let's just begin with a very general question. And actually, I don't even know how I would answer this, but like, what is an ecosystem service?
Well, the short answer is that it's all of the good things that nature does to benefit human society.
That's really beautiful. I like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue.
So, I mean, specific examples are things like clean water, clean air, wildlife habitat and biodiversity, carbon sequestration, resilience and adaptation to climate change or flood and drought or other extreme weather events. The list really does go on forever and ever. And food production, by the way, is an ecosystem service.
Right.
Probably the most important one that the agricultural landscape provides.
Okay, good. And I guess you kind of touched on this, but maybe we can dive in a little bit deeper. How do these ecosystem services benefit farms and ranches? Like, okay, I guess water is a pretty obvious one, but I don't know, maybe there's a few other things you can throw out there.
Yeah, farms are based on the ecosystem. Farming at its core is all about trying to produce things out of nature. Ecosystem services are producing things from nature. So there's so much correlation, and farming really can't happen without a lot of those ecosystem services that nature is providing. So we need good quality soil in order to grow things. We need water preferably clean water. We need biodiversity. We need pollinators on the landscape. We need, you know, just the diversity of plants for food resilience, for instance.
Okay, cool. And obviously with this program, or this, the overall Rural Roots to Climate Solutions project, we kind of got this climate thing going on. And I don't know if it's a bit of a stretch, but I'm just wondering, how do ecosystem services help us address climate change, or how are they connected to climate issues?
Well, I mean, there's two approaches to climate change, both in terms of mitigating the effects of potential changes to climate, as well as adapting or being more resilient to those changes when they happen. Now, humans, because we like to engineer things, we tend to think very much along the what we call the gray infrastructure model. So that's, let's build a dam, let's you know, put in some kind of an irrigation system, that kind of thing. And those effects, or those approaches, are certainly effective in some ways. But really, I think if we want to be the most effective, we need to be looking at what we call natural infrastructure, or green infrastructure is another word for it. And that is using nature's ability to provide these ecosystem services that we require. So by improving the vegetation on the landscape, for instance, the diversity on the landscape, making sure that our water has a place to go so we don't have excessive flooding, and be a place to collect so that if we do have a period of drought, we still have some access to surface water, for instance. Those kinds of things can really help us adapt to potential changes in the climate, as well as mitigate those changes as well, so that they aren't maybe as extreme.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty amazing that it does help both on the climate adaptation side as well as the climate mitigation side. So, yeah, I guess maybe on the mitigation side, we're talking like carbon sequestration, stuff like that. And then, yeah, on the adaptation side, just making more like resilient farms and ranches to droughts, floods, and I guess whatever the future may hold.
Yeah, and what's really neat is that it can usually, green infrastructure or natural infrastructure is usually orders of magnitude cheaper to do than built or gray infrastructure. So there's a pretty famous example out of New York City where they've faced some water treatment plant upgrades, and in doing their estimations, they figured it was going to cost about $8 billion to do these upgrades. Now, I don't know about you. If I reach into my wallet, I'm not going to find $8 billion pretty very fast.
If you said you could, I probably would roll you right
now. I don't think anybody working for nonprofits is ever really going to say that. But, you know, even if you're a city the size of New York and have that many taxpayers, it's a significant chunk of change. So, unsurprisingly, they looked at options, and somebody said, well, you know, that all that land upstream of the city could potentially be put to service in cleaning the water so that when the water reaches our treatment plants, the plant doesn't need to work as hard, and ergo we can stave off these upgrades for quite some time. And they looked at that and they said, well, what would that we need to do to make that happen? And turns out it was mostly farmland upstream. And in talking to the community, they said, well, we need some community-based solutions and we need to make it financially viable. So they found a way where they were paying farmers and ranchers to produce these ecosystem services, very similar to what Alice is doing now here in Canada. And they estimated it was going to cost about $1.5 billion. That's a savings of about $6.5 billion. Worth a shot, in my opinion. So they went ahead and did it, and that was fairly early days in using some of these natural infrastructure approaches, but it was very successful. And about 10 years later, they went back and they did a cost analysis, and they determined it came in right around that estimate. So they leveraged $6.5 billion out of nature. that not makes bad. Me happy as a taxpayer.
Oh, totally. I was even thinking, like, I haven't had really a chance to go out in rural Alberta much lately just because I was away. And I know we've had a huge melt all of a sudden. And the first thing when I heard about the snow melting very quickly, I was just like, oh, crap, all that moisture is just going to go flying off the land too quickly. And, like, those poor guys might not be able to fill up their dugouts as quickly. But I'm assuming something like or creating a farm that facilitates ecosystem services, maybe it would be a good defense or a good way to kind of catch that moisture if it is melting faster than it should be or faster than it normally does, that you might be able to put some of that green infrastructure like you were talking about to kind of like trap it on your land so it just doesn't all go flying into the river. Not saying the river doesn't deserve the water, but it's really hard to run an agriculture operation without that water.
It is. We need water for farming, and you know, it's also really important to slow down that water movement because that prevents soil erosion. We also, surprisingly, need good soil for farming. So having more slower water on the landscape is going to help to make sure that water is available and slow down the effects of flooding and soil erosion and help prevent those large scale floods where it just pools downstream very quickly.
All right. So we talked about how ecosystem services can address climate issues or climate change itself. How do the ecosystem services that farms and ranches are trying to facilitate or create or help out with, well, how does this help out biodiversity?
So that's one of the great things about incorporating some of these projects onto your farmland. One of the biggest criticisms of modern day farming is that we're farming in monoculture, you know, and there's advantages to doing so, certainly from the sort of, from the farmer's perspective, there's definitely advantages in doing so in terms of productivity and efficiency and all of those things. The potential negatives of farming in monoculture is that we're constantly extracting the same nutrients, for one. So adding more biodiversity back into the system can help to regulate and maintain better levels of soil nutrients. Can also help to facilitate things like pollinators for some of our species that do need pollinator support. For crops that do need pollinator support, farmers sometimes are bringing in pollinators at a cost. So having those kinds of things naturally available on the landscape can actually provide value to the farming operation.
Oh, cool. So it's something like it benefits biodiversity because you're creating that habitat for pollinators, for example. Mm-hmm. And then you as a producer, you're going to benefit from that because you're not, like, I've heard that with canola, sometimes I have to like bring in bees and stuff like that to do the pollination, but you've kind of got your raised pollination herd right there in that habitat you just created. Is it sort of along those lines?
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately diversity is one of the best things that we can do for resilience, whether it's climate change resilience or pest resilience or really anything that threatens farming. The more diversity we have, the better our crops are going to be able to actually respond to those things. So even having diversity in the natural landscape around can help to ameliorate pests, drought, flood, any of those threats.
Okay, so just kind of making sure that, you have a bunch of different tools and I guess your repertoire of growing things. I was thinking, I've always sort of wondered, when we did that farming with biodiversity workshop, the information I came across, and I'm skimming a lot of these documents because I'm really trying to promote the workshop and let the experts speak for themselves, but there was this, like, apparently there's a correlation between biodiversity and increased yields. And I know you're not working for Ag Canada or anything like that, so I wouldn't expect you to know the exact details on that. But when it comes to, like, why would that increase yields? And why does it make your farm more resilient because you have more biodiversity? I don't know if anybody has the answer for that. Perhaps you have an idea or two?
Well, I mean, from a simple biological concepts perspective, there's something called hybrid vigor. So it's kind of the concept down at the very genetic level, that the more diversity there is, the more chance that when a threat comes along, you might have some what we call alleles or traits that might help you combat it. And so if you have diversity within a population, even if you have, say, a pest that comes in and wipes out 60% of your crops, but if 40% have that adaptation that is going to allow them to withstand that pest, then your crop will survive, right? So it's the same kind of thing when we have that diversity in the broader ecosystem. The ecosystem also shares that resilience. So we, generally speaking, most ecosystems can withstand, you know, maybe losing one species or having, you know, some kind of catastrophic event happen to them. They're not going to lose the entire ecosystem. But if you have an ecosystem that has been whittled down to one or two species, well, all of a sudden something comes in that does cause that to collapse, you have nothing and you're starting from zero and you don't have some of those basic process makers, like the soil microbes, for instance, that can help to build the systems that it takes to then rebuild your crops, right? So overall that diversity helps to build resilience into the entire system.
Okay. Yeah, when you were describing that, I was actually thinking about like our own immunity to diseases. Like, there's, I know I shouldn't be talking about sick children right now because you have a very grumpy little toddler at home right now who probably misses his mom, and I'm very grateful you're here. But yeah, like how we try to expose kids to different, like chickenpox, different diseases, just so you can build up that immunity. So yeah, when you were talking about that, I was thinking, oh, maybe that's like with an ecosystem too.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
I learned something already. Okay, let's talk about Alice. Let's get more into the nitty-gritty.
So what's really neat about Alice is that we are farmer-delivered and community-developed. So each of our Alice programs is run by a community. Here in Alberta, we partner with the municipalities and the counties to run the program. So that's kind of the scale that it's working at. And within that, the community has what we call a partnership advisory committee. So it's local farmers and ranchers who really know the lay of the land. They understand the nitty gritty of what farming is actually like in that area. So it's not somebody from Ottawa or Toronto or something coming in and telling you how to farm here in Alberta. That doesn't work for anybody, right? And certainly not for Albertans.
I hadn't noticed.
Albertan born and raised, I can say that. You know, we like our autonomy, and we, to be honest, know how to work with our land.
Exactly.
Probably yeah. Better than anybody, right? So that's one of the neat things. And then the farmer themselves is sitting in the driver's seat. Throughout the whole process. So he or she looks at their land and says, these are the areas that are really great for farming for me. I want to produce a crop there. I want to graze my animals there, whatever the case may be. But every farm has those areas that are we would consider marginal for agricultural production. So maybe the area is wet and your tractor gets stuck there every year, or you get a crop off of it, maybe, you know, 1 or 2 years out of 4 or 5. Like, it's just not super productive. You're just kind of farming it to keep the weeds out, that kind of thing. You know, or it's a weird little corner. It's hard to get equipment in, or you have really steep banks and it's a danger to your livestock. Those are prime areas for an Alice project. It's not about taking land out of production, but it's about looking at every piece of your land and understanding what is the most efficient use for this land. Should it be producing crops? Should it be producing livestock? Or is there a third option? Can we produce ecosystem services? Alice says, yes, we can. So once the farmers identified where those areas are, they can work with the Partnership Advisory Committee and the Program Coordinator at the county level to decide what kinds of projects are viable on that piece of land. So, you know, being Alberta, being cattle country, we tend to like riparian fencing projects. They're very, very common here. They're kind of a low-hanging fruit because they're fairly easy to implement, and the producers see real value. Pretty well every producer I've talked to, and I'm not a farmer myself, so it was really eye-opening and exciting for me to start hearing these stories. But producers say that their cattle gain more weight because they're drinking clean water. Their cattle are happier, which that makes me happy. Happy cows, right? Because they don't.
Sure, happy cows taste better too.
Sure, yeah. They don't like getting their feet wet, right? I don't blame them. It's springtime. We're all feeling that right now.
Totally.
Farmers are happier because they're not out there, you know, pounding the ice in the middle of winter if they put in an offsite watering system that has sort of full season capabilities. And a lot of the systems now are really handy and portable, so you can actually move them around to different wetlands, so you can have a really nice bang for your buck. And then, as I said, the weight gain is more rapid, so that's really cool. But there's so many projects that can be done, and some of them are really innovative. I always say the sky's the limit if you can think about it, and it will increase ecosystem services. It is potentially an ALICE project. So we've had lots of eco buffers or drainage ditch rehabilitations, that kind of thing. But some of the unique projects are the ones that always get me, like ALICE Vermilion River. They have one project where they actually had an old barn that normally the producer would have just taken it down and would have put a crop through there at this point, or turned it into grazing land. But there were some bats roosting in that area. And, you know, with white nose syndrome marching westward, you know, bats are at a fair amount of risk right now. And so, their project was really unique. I'm actually not aware of any others like this, but they actually fenced off that barn and did some upgrades to make it more hospitable for the bats and for other wildlife that might potentially use that structure, and protected it from the cattle so that they weren't rubbing it. So there's lots and lots of flexibility.
Okay, so they're not just projects to do with water. It goes well beyond that.
Water's an easy thing for producers to think about, and I mean, certainly they would consider a lot of those wet spots to be marginal land. So a lot of our projects do end up being tied to water, but absolutely we work on uplands, and pivot corners are another really great opportunity. Anywhere where the land is marginal for agricultural production.
And I was also wondering, and I feel like because it's such a new thing, you guys might not have projects like this yet, but I did notice on the website you guys talk about carbon sequestration. So do you guys have any examples of what a carbon sequestration project would look like?
Yeah, to be honest, I would say that almost all of our projects are sequestering carbon to some degree.
Fair point, yeah.
Right? I mean, there are projects that are focused on more reforestation or woodlot kind of style projects, which sequester carbon over a longer term. But native grasses are really, really important in the carbon sequestration conversation. Deep-rooted species take that carbon and they sink it right down into the soil, where it actually gets locked up for much longer when it's grazed appropriately. And part of what ALICE can do, you know, depending on the project, depending on the community, is we can work with grazing regimes. So it's just about managing that grazing so that it is done in an ecologically friendly manner. We can actually increase the ecosystem services that are produced on that land using some grazing, because, you know, as you know, our prairie ecosystem was developed by bison and fire. We suppress fire and we have no bison roaming anymore. Mm-hmm. So what's our closest proxy? It's going to be cattle or other livestock.
Okay. And is there, I know you said you're not a farmer, but are there any sort of grazing systems that you guys recommend producers use?
Yeah. So Alice is not prescriptive. Okay. That's one of the really key tenets as well. It's a voluntary program, and the producer, you know, we don't want to go in and change the whole way that they're farming. We want that those sorts of decisions to still happen at the farm level. But we do want to make sure that they have the tools and the resources available to do that. So we work with lots of partner organizations like Cows and Fish or Agroforestry and Woodlot Extension Society to provide some of those options. So things like multi-paddock grazing or mob grazing kind of systems are sometimes appropriate for certain systems. Sometimes it's longer periods of rest. Sometimes, like in sensitive riparian areas, for instance, you may want to only do winter grazing where it's where the ground is a little bit less fragile. All of those kinds of things can be factored into their Alice agreement.
Okay. And then like once, so I'm a producer, I've entered into an agreement with Alice. The ecosystem services part, that's good for me, but is there, any, did you guys sweeten the deal with anything else? Is there any payment involved?
Yeah, so I mean, there's two approaches you can take with conservation. One is the stick, where you come in with regulations or some other kind of mechanism that says, thou shalt do X. Typically, I find particularly here in Alberta, that does not fly very well. But it's one technique. It can be effective. What Alice likes to use is the carrot, though. So instead, we offer, of course, the technical resources and the guidance, but we also do a payment for ecosystem services model. So what we pay on is the management and maintenance of our projects. Every project requires a little bit of care for it to perform optimally. And, you know, that has to come from somewhere, the producer's actually putting in that work. So we want to reward them for that. So every community sets all of their rates. So they're a little bit different, but in general, most communities are cost sharing with the producer to actually establish the project. So usually it's a 50-50, but that depends on the program, and sometimes there can be other cost sharing resources out there, like CAP, the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, things like that. So our program coordinators can help the producers navigate that whole system as well. And then the unique piece about Alice is that we actually do an annual payment for all of that management and maintenance. So it's kind of like we're contracting the producer to do that work on our behalf. It's one of the challenges conservation organizations always face is, you know, they'll get this land, it's under their sort of management, but once you have so much land, it's actually hard to get out there and manage it. So we're totally leveraging the on-the-ground land manager, and that's really what makes Alice so successful on the landscape.
And the fee or the payment, it's like a per acre payment, and is there like,
yeah.
I don't know, is there a price or an average? I'm sure it fluctuates depending where you, what province you're in and all that, but I don't know, just maybe to give folks an idea.
Yeah, it absolutely fluctuates depending on the community. We usually say land rental rates is kind of a starting point for the proxy, but from there, that partnership advisory committee or the PAC will set the rates. So it is usually a little bit tied to, you know, what the land was used for before and what kind of management change has been made, and then what kind of management effort is required. So for instance, if you have an open water system, the actual water part that was always wet, the producer is getting no value off of before. Some communities may pay a little bit less on that part, and then they'll pay more on the riparian area around that wetland where the producer's really actually putting in that effort. Other communities may say, no, we need wetlands badly in our area. We're going to pay higher for the wetland area. So it's really community developed. And I mean, payment rates can be fairly dramatically different. So people should contact their county or municipality to find out more about that.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And I think I really like how, like, it, not only is it not prescriptive Canada-wide, it's not prescriptive in Alberta, because it's just like the natural regions are so different that, like you were saying about wetlands, probably not an issue up north, but down south, like, they desperately need that kind of stuff. So just saying, no, we have this one thing that fits for the entire province, obviously it's just not going to work in agriculture here.
Exactly. And even within that, some of our communities are getting, even more variable with their payment systems, in that they're taking into account things like, how is the land being managed? Is it being grazed, in one way or another? Is this watering system going to affect 20 head or 200 head and that kind of thing? And they're starting to take into account all of those kinds of things as well. So it's actually a really interesting time to be involved with Alice, because there's lots of new and innovative things happening.
Okay. And then once the land has been designated as an Alice project, and I've put up my four strands of barbed wire and stuff like that, could I still use it? Can I graze cattle on the other side of the fence? Or has that just become like a no man's land for me?
Yeah. So that's the neat part about Alice as well. We were started by farmers and ranchers partially out of frustration for traditional approaches to conservation, which were to, put a fence around it and say, thou shalt not use that anymore. Different projects have different restrictions. It entirely depends on what makes sense for the farm and what makes sense for the project and the ecosystem services produced. So the PAC has lots of options. As I said, the program itself is voluntary, so when you sign an agreement, there are exit clauses and things like that. We do not go on title or put any kind of caveats on title. You're just bound by that conservation agreement, which will outline if there's anything specific that needs to happen. Usually, like, grazing can be allowed, but there might be restrictions like, this is a riparian area and we have migratory birds coming through this area. So maybe we'll just ask you to graze after the migratory bird fledging period. So usually after July 15th, depending on the area, or perhaps, limit the number of head of cattle or things like that. But all of that is done in consultation with the landowner, and there's usually ways of finding some kind of middle ground that works for everybody. So it's really neat.
Well, it's good there's that built-in flexibility, because I was just thinking, like, a farm that I'm not going to name because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. but I was on it. It was a drought and things were getting pretty rough. And I'm pretty sure there were Alice areas on that farm. And I think we wound up grazing them in the end just because we were desperate. There was nothing else we could do in that case. So it's good to know there's that flexibility built in.
And that's the nice thing too. Like, if that's the case, even if the original agreement is that you were going to do absolute exclusion because that area needed a good rest, you could come back in a period of drought, for instance, and say to the PAC, listen, like, we need to graze this land. This is the situation. And the PAC has the ability, because they're farmers and ranchers too, to look at the conditions and say, yeah, you know what? It makes sense for you to graze that land. You can do it within certain parameters where it's not going to affect the ecosystem services that are going to be produced, or maybe even improve or increase them. That's fine. Carry on and do it this year. Or they might say, well, yeah, it's going to have some effect. Maybe we'll do a half payment or something like that. Or they could potentially even pause the payment for that year and say, yeah, you know what? We're not going to get the ecosystem services off of it, or you're not doing that kind of management and maintenance, so it doesn't make sense to give you that annual payment. But we'll just pause it for the year. Hopefully next year is a better year and we'll restart then. And then worst case scenario, we could also, end the agreement. But that doesn't happen very often.
That's good to hear. And is it, because obviously there's other organizations working in this area too. So you have like Ducks Unlimited, NCC, which is the Natural Conservancy of Canada, I believe it is. Even Cows and Fish. If I have an Alice project, am I allowed to bring those guys onto my land as well? Is it possible to stack services, or does this ever happen? I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work together with other conservation organizations a lot. What we can't do is double dip. So, you know, partially that comes from just sort of like the philosophy of all the groups and the limited resources that everybody has. But also it comes from, you know, Revenue Canada and, you know, actual rules that we have to follow as well. But what will happen is those groups typically work on conservation easements or some kind of a titled system. So, you know, what we've seen happen is Ducks Unlimited, for instance, will go in and do a ditch plug and restore a wetland. And that's great. They have the water there and that's all under easement. But they don't have much of a buffer maybe beyond that actual wet area. So Alice then can come in and work beyond the easement area. We can't actually pay them for the area that's under easement. But if the farmer wants to extend that buffer and create more ecosystem services in that riparian area, then we can pay on that portion.
So it's almost not so much like stacking on top of each other, it's like stacking beside each other in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, yeah.
Cool. And I just out of curiosity, I don't even know if you're allowed to tell me. No, I'm sure you can. Anyway, I'm just curious, where does the money come from actually that Alice is then using to pay producers?
Yeah, so we are very lucky. We've had very generous support from the W. Garfield Weston Foundation as our foundational partner. We also work with a number of corporate entities, philanthropic funders, some government grants. And here in Alberta, the municipalities themselves are absolutely integral in making sure that the project is a success. Even if they're not injecting cash directly into the program, they're usually providing all of the support system that the program needs to take place. So the program coordinator, staff wages, for instance, office space, trucks, that kind of thing. So that piece really is kind of the pillar of success for Alice in Alberta. And then from there, we build out using
It's pretty amazing because I remember reading a report a little while back just about rural municipalities, and I guess it applies everywhere in Canada, but also in Alberta. It's just they're so cash strapped right now. It's just like their population is dwindling. Yeah, maybe if they have oil and gas development in the area, it's a little bit easier. But from what I understood, they're having so much trouble just meeting like basic services in their municipality, and then taking something like this on top of it. It's actually really impressive.
It is. I think it demonstrates the commitment that rural municipalities have to first of all, agricultural stewardship, but then also to environmental stewardship in their region. And more we're seeing that they're valuing their natural capital and recognizing that they're losing it at a rapid pace. And so, you know, if they could do things using mechanisms like Alice, it could actually be cheaper in the long run for them. For instance, how else are you going to do surface water management? You can go in and regulate it and use that stick, or you can offer some kind of a carrot and say, okay, we're gonna do this. Because we're also able to bring in external funders, you know, some municipalities like that as well, because we're kind of blending funding sources. And then the nice thing as well is Alice leverages really well with existing agro-environmental programming. So usually a municipality isn't hiring somebody as the Alice coordinator. They're taking their agricultural fieldman or their conservation coordinator or some similar existing role, and they're saying, hey, I know you're busy, but here's one more thing to do. You know, and then as the program grows and shows its success, and the county gets to see the value, then they can build on the position from there. So it can become a full-time position for sure.
Okay, no, it really speaks to the power of collaboration. And just, I think in general, in the agriculture community, there's just, there is so much of that working together. So I think, yeah, you guys are a perfect example of how they can work on an even larger scale.
Yeah, that's really neat.
So for a producer who wants to get involved in ALICE or have an ALICE project on their land, what's their first step?
So the first step would be to contact the county office. Usually talking to your agricultural fieldman or a member of your agricultural service board is a good place to start. We aren't in every municipality in Alberta yet. We are in 13 rural municipalities and growing. We have a waiting list of municipalities that do want to come on board that we're just, we're growing very much at a sustainable pace, making sure that we can provide all the supports that are required. But if your community doesn't have an ALICE program yet, there's a good chance that they're kind of thinking about it or looking at what their options are, whether it's ALICE or other programming. So they may have an alternative for you, and or they'll probably kind of be taking names and trying to understand what the demand is in their county. So even if the program doesn't exist, it's important to hear from you.
Okay. And in... I don't know. This might be a hard one to answer as well. I keep doing this to you. I'm just wondering. Recently I received an email from a producer in Coronation, and she's very, very passionate about the wetlands, riparian areas on her land, but there was no ALICE coordinator I could really point them towards. So, I don't know, what's your recommendation in that case? Is it just start engaging with your county, or just, like, I think the neighboring county, like Flagstaff or something like that, they may have had an ALICE coordinator. Is it about talking to them? I don't know if you have any tips.
Yeah, I mean, It's always a little bit heartbreaking when I get a call from a producer who really wants to do something and there is no program available for them. There is no harm in talking to other ALICE coordinators from outside of your area, though, because while the funding mechanism may not be in place, those technical resources are still there, and those people are founts of knowledge, and they may not be able to help you, you know, hold your hand the whole step of the way, but they can at least point you in the right direction of resources that would be able to help, maybe provide a fact sheet or something like that. And there's always ways to get started from that perspective. And if you do think that, you know, ALICE is the right way to go, then definitely talking to your county council or agricultural service board or your ag fieldman would be the right way to sort of push that along.
Okay. So my last question is, it's still on topic, but I guess it goes in a more existential direction. I seem to end every episode like this these days. I'm just getting weirder and weirder as we go along. But you're a biologist by training, so you're probably aware of the fact that wildlife populations across the globe, they're just not doing well. I was just skimming over a World Wildlife Fund report, and they're saying the species decline on average is about 60%, and that's over like just the last four decades, which is quite sad and horrifying at the same time. Habitat loss has been identified as one of the leading causes of the species decline. And, like, in all honesty, a lot of that habitat loss has been driven by agriculture and forestry. So my question is, agriculture help create the problem we have right here. Is agriculture the right solution to this problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's what a loaded question.
Yeah, my stomach's in knots right now, actually.
Okay, so I have a lot to say on the topic. First of all, let's frame it in the context of, yes, there's declines happening, there's also increases happening, right? Okay. What's bad for one species might be good for another species. So we can, you started the podcast framing it that we are part of the ecosystem. So other species are not doing so well. Humans, though, have done these things. Like, we've gone in and modified our landscape so that we can do well. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that part of it. And I think that's where we need to frame and contextualize this kind of conversation from, is instead of, you know, looking back and saying, oh, you shouldn't have done that, you know, 50, 100 years ago, I think we need to understand that people throughout our history, we do the best we can with the resources and the knowledge that is available to us. Would we have done something a little bit differently if we had different different knowledge? Maybe. But at the end of the day, we also still need to feed our population too, right? You know, every member of every population, human or animal or vegetable, we're all kind of inherently selfish, and we need the landscape to work for us, right? So framing it in that in that kind of light, I think whether it's agriculture or any other industry, we just need to look at what actually needs to be done. So we need food. Okay, so agriculture is not going away. We also have people who need to make their living off of agriculture. So we need to do agriculture in a way that is economically viable as well. Okay, so we have those layers. Well, now we're also recognizing that these environmental attributes are also critically important. And it turns out we need clean water. We maybe need to sequester more carbon. We need to have more diversity on the landscape. All of these things. So how can we layer all of it on and find ways to make all of this work? The only way we're going to do that, I argue, is by taking a holistic approach and looking, like we said, down to the individual level of what is this, you know, square meter of land best suited to? Is it agriculture? Is it environment? Is it some other use? And using it for that. And then adapting as new knowledge comes out as well. So if we find out that we're doing something wrong, let's not mire ourselves in the, we shouldn't have done that and finger pointing. Let's just accept the fact that our knowledge has changed and move on and look towards the future. So, you know, what are we going to need 50 years from now? Like, let's start looking at that target instead of, you know, what happened 50 years ago. And producers have such a unique place in this whole system. They really should have the keys. They have the skill set. Like, literally what they do is produce things out of nature. So they're really great at producing crops or livestock. Why can't they be great at producing ecosystem services too? I mean, this city girl, what am I going to do? I don't have the land to do it, and I don't have the skill set. I mean, sure, I'll do what I can, but the farmer down the road knows a hell of a lot more than I do. So let's give him or her the tools, the resources, and the support to be able to do that so that all of us can benefit. And let's trust the people who live off the land and rely on that land to do the right thing, because 99 times out of 100, they will. And that last 1%, probably if they have the right information, they will too. Rural Roots to Climate Solutions is a Central Alberta-based project empowering agricultural producers with climate solutions. Based in Stettler, Rural Roots runs workshops and farm field days, produces this podcast series, and hosts webinars. For more information, please go to our website at www.rr2cs.ca. We'd like to thank the Alberta Real Estate Foundation for providing financial support for the podcast, and the Advisory Committee of Rural Roots to Climate Solutions for providing Derek with much needed and much appreciated support. Members of the Advisory Committee are Brenda Barrett, Dana Penrice, Mark Fox, and Kimberly Cornish. Today's episode was recorded at Media Lab YYC in Calgary and was edited by Kyron Mountain of Mountain Media in Red Deer.
I'd also like to dedicate this episode to Grandad Leahy, who passed away just a few weeks ago, and also to all the Leahys in Canada who are missing him right now. The man hated vegetables with a passion, but for a guy of his generation to care about climate change was really, really amazing and heartwarming. And I'm really happy I have his compassionate and caring blood running through my veins.
And the world is too. Happy farming wherever you are in Alberta. And remember, what's good for the farm is usually good for the climate.